Hello friends, this is your host Rashmi Kandwal and we are live with our very first episode of the Patient Innovations podcast brought to you by Healthcare MN. Patient Innovations is a podcast sharing patient voices and innovation stories from Minnesota and beyond. Join us as we spotlight the latest research and breakthroughs, startups and connecting patients, funders and clinicians. I have here with me today my co-host Mary McCarthy.
Hello, everyone. Great to join you today. We looked up a few statistics about colorectal cancer because Rashmi and I are really into data, as I'm sure our hosts, our guests are as well. Colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer in the United States and worldwide in men and women combined, and it's the second most common in women after breast cancer. The risk factors for colorectal cancer include excess body fat, eating processed meats, and drinking two or more alcoholic drinks per day, among other risk factors. There are things you can do to lower your risk, such as eating whole grains and foods with fiber, and moderating alcoholic intake and daily moderate physical activity. And looking at the incidence rates for colorectal cancer, it's actually dropped every year, about 1% per year. But in people younger than 55, rates have actually been increasing 1 to 2% per year since the mid-1990s. There are about 1.9 million new cases in 2020 worldwide, and colorectal cancer is expected to cause around 53,101 deaths in the U.S. in 2024. So those are some great statistics to kind of ground you in the prevalence of this very nasty disease.
Thank you, Mary. How about we start with introducing our guests? Today in studio, we have with us Megan Wallace. She's a survivor of colorectal cancer. In addition, we have Dr. Subri Subramanian. He's a professor in Department of Surgery at University of Minnesota. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford University and joined the faculty at the University of Minnesota in 2007. He has established an internationally recognized cancer research program focused on colorectal cancer with a number of publications under his belt. As a co-founder and chief scientific officer of EV Therapeutics, Inc., Dr. Subramanian is at the forefront of developing treatments for advanced stage colorectal cancer patients.
And to provide the clinical perspective, we also have with us Dr. AJ Prakash, an award-winning medical oncologist trained at NYU. He specializes in the role of the microbiome in cancer, including multiple publications and developing a probiotic therapeutic program. He also has a special focus on investigating healthcare disparities in cancer outcomes and how to eliminate them, which is an objective close to my heart.
So let's get started. We'll start every episode from here on with the voice of the most important person here, the patient. And so we'll move to Megan. We're so glad that you're here with us, Megan. How about we start with sharing your experience leading up to your diagnosis?
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name is Megan Wallace, and in May of 2021, I turned 50 years old. Also, the screening age in 2021 dropped to 45 for colon cancer screening. So it was on my radar to have a colonoscopy. What I didn't want to do was a colonoscopy because of all the stories that I had heard from people about the prep and everything. And so I talked to my doctor, and she said that since I don't have a family history and I did not have any symptoms, I was just doing the colonoscopy because I was 50, that I could do a Cologuard test, which is a stool DNA test. So I signed up for that. They sent it to me, and then it sat in my closet for 3 to 4 months because I didn't want to do that either. Finally did it. They keep texting you and saying, you need to send this back into us, you know, and so I did. That went, you mail it in or UPS it back in, and it came back positive. Like I said, I didn't have a family history. I did not have any symptoms. I, at the time, got a positive, and I thought, oh, it's a false positive because they do have a small chance of those. And I thought, well, I don't have anything going on, so it must be a false positive. So I went in for a colonoscopy a week later. I woke up to a doctor telling me when I was still kind of out of it that I most likely had colon cancer. and that was pretty serious. I had a, I think it was a 1 to 2 centimeter tumor in my sigmoid colon, just kind of on the left side down before the rectum. So that was pretty traumatic for me to wake up and hear those words, because I was not expecting that at all. And like I said, I didn't have symptoms that I thought were symptoms, but now looking back, I guess I did have symptoms, but I didn't know they were symptoms. So I had constipation on and off for many years. I'd have some stomach pain after I'd eat, but I kind of just thought that was just a baseline for me. We all have stomach issues where we eat something or we don't feel well, or we eat the wrong foods and we get constipated. So yeah, so it's really important for people to get screenings, because I did have surgery. I met with a surgeon and they took out about a foot of my colon, and I had robotic surgery. So I was only in the hospital for 2 days. It was great. I was really nervous about the surgery. I thought I was going to have like a colostomy or an ostomy. I didn't really know anything when I heard colon cancer. That's what I thought. But she did a robotic surgery, took out the cancer, got clear margins, and then connected everything back up. And I was home in 2 days recovering. Yeah.
It's so quite a story.
Yeah. It's pretty wild that the treatment is really pretty advanced, because they go in with the robot arms and she sits at a computer and does the surgery. So less invasive, quicker recovery time, no ostomy, no colostomy. So things have come quite far. Fortunately, they do a pathology on the tumor because it was cancerous, and they did find one lymph node that was positive. So that sent me to an oncologist. Preventative chemo is what is suggested to do. And so I did do 6 rounds of chemo.
Okay, that's when you got your chemo done.
Yep.
Okay.
So I had my surgery in March. I had about 4 weeks recovery, and then I started chemo.
So this was all over a span of a year and a half?
I found out I had cancer in February of 2022. I finished chemo in July of 2022. So it was pretty
Okay.
They get you in and everything done pretty quick.
How do you feel today?
I feel much better today. It's been 2 years since my surgery. It was just a couple days ago. I celebrated 2 years, and that's what I call my cancerversary, which is when I was considered NED, because the doctor did get clear margins and got the cancer out, and the chemo was preventative. It took me a long time to get to feeling better. I would say I probably felt pretty bad after chemo for a good year. And I do still have permanent side effects. I have neuropathy in both my feet, and I have what's called chemo brain, where I struggle sometimes to find the words or kind of have to stop and think about what I'm trying to say. So,
yeah, well, I get that today.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, congratulations on your 2-year anniversary.
Thank you.
Really
Thank
glad you. That yeah. you're feeling a lot better.
Definitely. Yeah.
For a minute, for the listeners, can we go back to the symptom part? When you said you had no symptoms, what are some classic symptoms for people who do have symptoms?
So the classic symptoms that they tell you to look for are constipation, blood in your stool or mucus in your stool, change in bowel habits, sometimes like pencil thin stool, because what is happening is there's a tumor that's blocking the stool coming out, so you can sometimes see thin. Some people have pain in their intestinal area, but unfortunately, colon cancer is a cancer that you don't have symptoms really until you're pretty far advanced,
okay.
Which is why we want people to get screened.
For sure. Well, I know I'm way over 50, and I also waited to get it done. Luckily, I did not have any serious issues, but for everyone out there, go get tested.
Yep.
Go get it done.
There's lots of tests out there. And I always say the joke's on me, because honestly, now I've had, I don't know, three or four colonoscopies. It's really not that bad. There's a lot of stuff out there where people make you think it's going to be this horrible experience. It's actually not. The prep has changed a lot in the last couple of years, and it's kind of like a day and a half of you start the prep and then clean yourself out. And then you go in, and it's a pretty quick procedure. Actually, it's about a 30-minute procedure. Then you wake up. I mean, it's a great nap. I will say that it's a really nice nap. And then you wake up, and lots of people go off and get something to eat, because most people are going to wake up with no concerns, right? So what I tell people is a colonoscopy beats chemo any day, hands down. You don't want to do the chemo. It's life-changing.
Yeah. Just to change the perception out there a little bit. When I had my colonoscopy, I didn't even take any painkillers. There are a couple moments I was like, that's uncomfortable, but I was able to get through it. And the great thing was I was able to drive home right afterwards.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
My husband was still there to pick me up, but I could have driven home without an issue. So it really isn't that big of a deal. People just need to ovary up or man up and get it done.
Yep. I would definitely say that that is important to get those screenings done, please.
Yes. So, Megan,
yes.
If you had a magic wand, thinking about your experiences, how would you change treatments available today?
So the first thing I would change would be the screening age. I know we're working hard to get it below. It just got changed to 45, but it really should be lower. You know, with family history, probably starting at 30, but I would say that it needs to be lower. And we're working. A lot of the people that I work with in the community are working on that.
I'm thinking like the side effects of chemo brain, so maybe new drugs.
I don't know. I know there's a lot out there with clinical trials and immunotherapy. And so the nice thing about my treatment is that the standard of care 5 years ago was 12 rounds of chemo, and they did a 10-year study. And so I was able to do six rounds of chemo because they did this long-term study. So they are lessening the chemo exposure. But yeah, it would be nice if we could not have the side effects from chemo. And the thing about colon cancer is it's treatable and preventable if found early. So if we can just get people screened, we won't even have to go down a chemo. It's just taking out that polyp, all the polyps, any polyps. That's what turns into cancer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So once you got diagnosed, what was like, once it hit you, what was the first thing you were thinking about, or what were those emotions, or maybe like, you know, what I want to, like, challenges is what I want to understand. Like, if somebody gets diagnosed, are there some things that hit them right away? Are there ways that they can navigate them more effectively if there was more help available, and what's missing?
What I think is missing is mental health care. I work in mental health, so luckily for me, I know how to navigate the system, but it was really traumatic for me to have that diagnosis and then to go through this treatment. I didn't know anything about cancer. It just hasn't been part of my existence. I mean, I've heard of it, obviously, but no one in my family. When you're first diagnosed, everyone's there. The doctors are calling you. You're getting blood work. You're always surrounded. You go through chemo. The nurses are there every week. How are you doing? Checking in and everything. So it's kind of like you have a lot of people around you. And then when you're done, they're like, okay, congratulations, you finish. And then you're just set free. We'll see you in 6 months. We want to do blood work. And that's when it kind of hits you that you just went through this really traumatic experience. And now you're all alone on an island. Like, you talk to your family, but they don't get it, right? They get what the caregiver part, but they don't understand what you've been through. So what I would love to see is more support from doctors, treatment, even oncology offices, where they would have mental health, somebody that can check in with you after, when you're over here, you know.
And the other side of the procedure is done.
Yeah. Okay. Once you're kind of, luckily there's a lot of support out there, and I have found that support group now. I didn't have that when I was first diagnosed, but I did find it. It is out there. It would be nice if doctor's offices or your treatment team could connect you to that, because I think support is really important when you're going through cancer. You need to be able to connect with people who understand what you're going through.
So for a patient, new patient, like if somebody's diagnosed today, what would you say? Like, what are some of your favorite resources that really helped you? Like, okay, you are diagnosed now. Like, I would advise you to reach out to these things.
Well, the first thing I did was, unfortunately, go on Dr. Google, which I don't recommend, but we all do it. And it's just how we are as human beings. We want the answers. But there are some great advocacy groups out there. I've worked with Colon Town, which is like a Facebook-based group, and there's lots of support there. There's Colon Cancer Alliance. There's Colon Cancer Coalition. So there are places out there where you can get connected with people. But it would be, I really find that it would be nice if when you're going through the treatments, the doctors can give you that information or set you up with a therapist that can even just teach you some, you know, coping skills, or here's how to manage these feelings that you're going to have, or here's some people you can reach out to. I was never offered that, and I don't think many people are, because I work in a lot of advocacy, and that's something that I've been really kind of trying to push, is the mental health, because there's a need for it.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate your advocacy and sharing your personal story with us and with everyone who's listening.
You're welcome. Remember to get your screenings done, everyone.
Yes. Yes. Thanks. Thanks, Megan.
Yep.
So, Dr. Subramanian, thanks for joining us. We're honored that you have decided to join our very first podcast. Let's start with, why do you research in this field? Is there a personal reason why you're interested in colorectal cancer, or is there another reason for that?
First of all, thank you for having me here in this program. So, cancer is something that I was always working in from my postdoctoral training as a researcher. So my grandmother and my great uncle had cancer in the family. So that's to begin with. So that's what kind of attracted towards the cancer research field. So when I started working in sarcomas to begin with. So then I heard that colon cancer is a second kind of cause of cancer-related death in this country. So we slowly started working in colon cancer. And as you know, this year alone, there will be more than 50,000 patients dying of this disease. So we have to do something about this disease.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about your research in this disease.
So as you may know, when we started with cancer treatment, generally people think of chemotherapy and maybe targeted therapy. And the last 10 years, there's a new term called immunotherapy that really changed the way we think cancer. And primarily, we also know that, okay, some patients treated with immunotherapy, we are using the word cure now. That's the first time it's happening in cancer treatment. So unfortunately, if you look at colon cancer, only like 5 to 10% of the patients are even candidates for immunotherapy. The remaining 90% of the patients are currently not a candidate for immunotherapy.
Wow.
So that's a big number, right? So how to understand like why these patients are not responding to immunotherapy, how we can bring them as a candidate for immunotherapy is a bigger question in the lab that we are asking. So primarily to understand how cancer evades immune response is a key question that we wanted to know, and understanding the mechanisms that kind of helps a cancer evading the immune response will be the first thing. So with that, we started our research program.
Okay. And can you share with us how your research fits into the broader research field of colorectal cancer?
So colon cancer is like one of the leading cancer, like we already discussed. So really understanding how we can take the newer drugs, like, for example, Keytruda, it's an immunotherapy drug. So it's been working for other cancer types like melanoma. Can we use Keytruda in colon cancer patients? So right now, only 5 to 10% of patients are responding. So if we bring more patients for immunotherapy, that'll be a big thing in terms of treatment. So in a broader scheme, in other cancer types, immunotherapy is working. Right now, colon cancer patients, majority of them are not responding to the treatments. So how we can bring them as a therapy.
So what are some challenges you're facing in bringing more patients in for immunotherapies, and how are you dealing with those challenges?
So the challenges is not bringing more patients. The question is like why they are not responding to immunotherapy. So for example, not to use like technical terms here, but microsatellite instable patients, they're like 5 to 10% of the patients, they are now a candidate for immunotherapy. The remaining 90% of the patients are microsatellite stable patients. They are not even candidate for immunotherapy at this point. So really understanding why they are not responding and how we can bring them as a treatment. So one thing what we found in the lab is there are specific mechanisms that cancer is using to evade the immune response. So one thing that evolved along with cancer is our immune system. So millions of years cancer exists, but the immune system has seen that forever. So if we really make our own immune system strong enough, right, to fight the cancer, many times we succeed in that. So how to really make our immune system stronger so that it kind of finds the cancer, fights the cancer and then kills the cancer cell specifically. That's what we want to touch you. And some understanding the mechanisms, how it is doing, meaning how is cancer is evading, so then we can stop those mechanisms and then kind of kill those cancer cells. So this can help the patient. So pretty much if you wanted to see, most of the time combination treatment is something that we are kind of using. So if you use chemotherapy and maybe a targeted therapy, if you bring the immunotherapy as a combination, that'll be a win-win situation for patients as well as everyone.
Can you explain the immunotherapy approach generally for people who are not familiar with that term?
So cancer is not an overnight mechanism. It happens over multiple years. So usually what happens is when cancer is developing or evolving, it puts a brake on our immune system slowly. And the immune system completely stops working and then it's not even caring about the cancer cells in the body. So it doesn't care the cancer cells. So what's happening is if we know that what's the mechanism of cancer killing. So for example, the what we call T cells or lymphocytes, they go on to something called anergic, meaning they're no longer functional in the body. And like for simple extent, they go on to a longer term sleeping mode. So how we can wake up those immune cells, so-called T cells, and make them to work better. So the drugs like mentioned, Keytruda is one good example. It wakes up the sleeping immune cells, like T cells specifically, and then make them to work a little bit more energetically, and that can go and kill the cancer.
Okay, thank you for that explanation.
Can you talk a little bit about your the EV therapeutics.
So EV Therapeutics is a startup company that was started almost 2 years back from my laboratory. As a terms of, we found a mechanism how cancer evades immune response. So one thing what we found is cancer cells secretes something called exosomes. In a simplistic term, let's say a garbage bag. So whatever the cell doesn't want, it throws it out. For example, the cancer cell doesn't need something, it just throws it out. So what we found is in those smaller vesicles or the smaller bags, they contain immune suppressive factors in them. So when the immune cells are in the tumor environment, they take up this content or the vesicle content, and these immune cells stop functioning anymore. So the cancer indirectly, it's like a Trojan horse. They hide something inside and then send it to the immune cells and then make the stop the function of the immune cells. So we found out this mechanism and also found what is the immune suppressive factor in them. Right? So what we are using is these EVs or exosomes. We are removing the immune suppressive factors and then allowing the EVs or exosomes to do its job, meaning they contain tumor antigens. I don't want to go into more technical details. So basically the idea here is we are removing the immune suppressive mechanisms and allowing the exosomes to immunogenically activate the immune response. So that's how we found out that the exosomes can be a drug that can be used to these patients. More importantly, when we use these exosomes in animal models, it brings more immune system to the immune cells to the tumor environment, and thereby the animal models or the patients we are giving to them, they become a candidate for immunotherapy. So remember, I told you 90% of the patients don't even respond to immunotherapy. Now giving these exosomes, or what we call as an engineered exosomes, they become a candidate for immunotherapy. So that's one way to really bring more number of patients and then treat them with immunotherapy.
Okay. Yeah, that explains. Yeah.
So I just left the University of Minnesota where I worked in the Venture Center, and you and I didn't get a chance to work together, but EV Therapeutics is talked about in the office quite a bit. What is the current status of EV Therapeutics?
So right now we are in a fundraising mode for the startup. So as the COVID just ended up, so it was a challenge to really go and talk with the venture capitalists. Right now we are kind of having a lot of collaborators around the country and also speaking with venture capitalists to bring in more funding. So it's still in initial stages of development. So anything we develop in the lab has to be a clinical grade to be used in the patients. So right now we are trying to generate more clinical grade product that can be going for clinical trials. So I'm also working with Dr. Ajay Prakash as well as Dr. Emil Liu, who are oncologists at the University of Minnesota. Along with them, we are trying to see how we can take these exosomes as a novel therapy for patients as a clinical trial program.
So one interesting question has to do with dreaming. If you could get 10 times the amount of funding that you get now, what would you do to advance your research?
If you look at the treatments of colorectal cancer in general, the first line of treatment or standard of care is using 5-fluorouracil. And this drug was introduced in 1962 for the patients. For the last 60 years, that's been a standard of care. So how we can change that? So having more funding will allow us to really bring in more immunotherapy concepts and then drugs to the patients. So that will help them to really be for better outcomes. So having more money in terms of funding, especially when the National Institute of Health has limitations in funding. So having more additional funds will help us to take this to the next level into clinical trials and really test our drug products and then reach the patients.
Wonderful. And so if any listeners wanted to learn more about your research, how could they research it?
So I work at the University of Minnesota. We have a laboratory which is primarily focused on colorectal cancer. Our website at the University of Minnesota with my lab link provides all the information, what exactly we are working on, what the stage of each project. And we also have a significant interest in microbiome. And that's all the information that will be available, readily available for anyone who wants to learn more.
Wonderful.
That's great.
Thank you, Dr. Subramanian. We really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So thanks for joining us, Dr. Ajay Prakash. We're thrilled that you took time out of your busy clinical practice to join us and share with us your insights into colorectal cancer and how you incorporate current treatments and innovation, such as Dr. Subramanian's work, into your daily practice with your patients.
Of course, happy to be here.
Super. So we're curious about the typical presenting patient. So a patient comes in and they've got a concern. Tell us what happens next.
Yeah, so that's a challenging question because there really is no typical patient. Everybody has their own unique story. But often the people that come into my clinic represent the broad spectrum of the American colorectal cancer diagnosis. We have an increasing proportion of patients showing up below the age of 50, but the majority of patients still remain over the age of 65. But being over 65, you know, I don't know what it brings to mind in, for example, you know, anybody's mind, but these are incredibly active, vigorous people who have rich and fulfilling lives. And so really don't want their cancer treatment to take away from that. Don't want their cancer diagnosis to take away from that. So when somebody comes to us, our job is primarily to help them beat the cancer, if that's within our power to do so. But we need to keep in mind the context of their care and ensure that our treatments are tailored to whatever their specific life goals may be.
Yeah, that's a concept I just heard recently, is you want to keep your body doing, meeting the goals that you have for what you want your body to do. So I totally understand that. So when you think of the current treatment options available, what kind of pains you about the current options?
I guess one of the things I like to always learn more about is, you know, patient experience. And it's one of the things, obviously, you guys are centering in this discussion. And so, you know, I'm a little curious, you know, from your end, are there complaints that you've heard people bring to you about the nature of the experience of being treated with cancer?
I would say not necessarily being treated, but what I hear when I talk to people is, so one is like this emotional challenge they get into suddenly when they get diagnosed. So that's the biggest I think I hear of, that then like once they get the diagnosis, suddenly it is like, oh, I don't know where to go to. And I keep hearing that there are not existing pathways for such patients. So that is one thing that I hear. In terms of what is available out there for treatment, that's good. That's already good. They get the care. But kind of navigating is a challenge for the patients. So
that's exactly what I had in mind. So that's something that we hear as well. So we, as the outward-facing face of the clinical team, along with my nurses and staff, our patients see us, and they believe that because they see us, we hold a significant amount of control over their experience. But a lot of it occurs outside of anything that I have the capacity to change, which still doesn't make it unimportant. The process of making an appointment, negotiating with their insurance for coverage, even something as seemingly trivial as parking, all of these can take a significant emotional toll even before a patient has stepped into our offices. And I think that at least within our practice, across all of the colleagues I've spoken with, all of whom, you know, across both southeastern Minnesota and across several cancer centers are fantastic, there's really a focus in trying to ensure that we accommodate these needs as well. And we know that our power as oncologists is limited. And so we will often engage ancillary groups. So we'll bring in a social worker to help them negotiate certain financial situations, help them gain access to resources that the state has made available, thankfully. Well, we will provide recommendations to see mental health services, a group called palliative care, which, despite the preconception of many patients, are actually a significant benefit for patients who are not sort of at the end of their road or anything of the kind. They're just an incredibly talented group of physicians who help in patient care. We're actually going beyond that, if I can sort of, you know, monologue for a minute. At the university, we have a couple of developing programs to see if we can do more. One that I'm particularly excited about is being run by one of my colleagues, Dr. Arjun Gupta, looking to see if the addition of free legal care at the beginning of the diagnosis can alleviate some of these issues that you've brought up already.
Just amazing if that can happen.
That would be fantastic. And we're looking forward to that trial opening later this year. You talked about the treatments. They are good, but they're challenging to tolerate, even for patients, you know, who jump through the hoops I've already mentioned. And we talked about how patients are very functional and want to maintain that function. That's part of one of the trials that I'm opening up with Dr. Subramanian, looking to see if we can provide subtle ancillary benefits using existing technologies. So this is where our thoughts around how do the bacteria and the gut interact with cancer and all of these technicalities come into play. But the short answer is we're looking to see if bacterial supplementation during the course of chemotherapy, a particular treatment that wipes out the gut bacteria on a regular basis, if that can help to alleviate some of the many issues that people have with nausea, diarrhea, all of this GI distress that is fairly de rigueur for most of my patients.
So for a minute, I wanted to go back to the original discussion in the beginning when we were talking about, you made a comment saying there are more patients that you see that come at age of 65 plus, but you also now increasingly see some of them who are under 50. So what has changed? Like, are you doing more outreach, or is it just because the number of patients that are getting colorectal cancer when they are under 50, that has increased and they are not necessarily coming to you for a diagnosis of colorectal cancer, but just for something else, and on the side they get diagnosed? So what's going on there?
That's a great question. So the unfortunate fact of the matter is that these actually do represent a change in our underlying cancer incidence, because people under the age of 50 are not regularly screening, or at least weren't until the guidelines changed. So if you look at the incidence of cancer, as a for example, over 2023, patients under the age of 50 have about half the incidence patients between the ages of 45 and 49 have about half the incidence of colon cancer as patients between the ages of 50 and 55. But that incidence is not zero. And that number drops again for the next age cohort, 40 to 45. But again, that number is not zero. So you have these diagnoses that are occurring in the setting of new cancer diagnoses. And again, pulling from our national data, which lags a few years, 2019 is the most recent data for which our national database called SEER includes its data. About 13% of all new cancer diagnoses were under the age of 50. I mean, that's a lot of people. And so, you know, we don't know exactly why it's happening. It is likely environmental because it's challenging to find a common biologic or genetic cause between all of the patients that we see. And they really span the spectrum of people in terms of life experience and things like that. So it feels like it must be something in our society.
Thank you for that. So moving to our next question, what excites you and gives you hope about emerging research in colorectal cancer?
Yeah, so I'm a biased response to that because the reason I do this, the reason I've chosen this career is because the future does excite me. A lot of things have occurred over the course of the past two decades and are occurring now that could fundamentally change the way that we treat colon cancer, colorectal cancers. I already mentioned a couple of clinical trials that we're opening up that are just looking at the patient experience, how they feel through treatment. That could change the future for our patients. But just talking about treatment, we can highlight a few things just from the past couple of years. So there's a technology called circulating tumor DNA or cell-free DNA, which has been developed over the course of the past several years, which is able to really detect the recurrence of a cancer long before it's present on imaging. It's been validated across a couple of very, very specific cancer scenarios, and right now doesn't have a use outside of those scenarios, but one could easily envision a future where we are regularly using this tool to help monitor our patients and to provide them intervention to prevent the recurrence of cancer as it's being detected. That future is likely far away because, remember, the tools that we have to fight cancer are still the same ones that we have. So we need to modify both the tools and the diagnostics simultaneously. Just making leaps and bounds in one is insufficient to solve this problem altogether. Another area that excites me that Dr. Subramanian already brought up is the area of immunotherapy. As he mentioned, it's utility is really limited within our patients to a very small population. And so we want to be able to bring that to more and more patients. So trials including his extracellular vesicle EV Therapeutics company, along with novel immunotherapeutic agents being developed in Europe, could really bring this to the forefront. We could be talking again in years to come about immunotherapy being a standard for almost every patient that's diagnosed with colorectal cancer, hopefully to their significant benefit.
Are you a PI on or principal investigator on any of these trials, and are you looking for more patients?
That's a great question. The short answer is I am a principal investigator in an effort to avoid any potential conflict. I'm not going to advertise for trial enrollment here, but I will say that the university, as with Mayo Clinic, all of the oncologists in the city talk to one another. I've got almost everybody's number in my phone. We text all the time. So find somebody, talk to somebody, and they'll get you to us if we're the right place for you.
Okay, super. Thank you, Dr. AJ Prakash. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to join us and educate us on how patients are currently treated. So appreciate it.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it, my friends. That's a wrap on our episode number 1 on colorectal cancer. The key takeaway for me in today's episode was what Dr. Subri said, that prevention is better than cure. And so bringing in more colonoscopies to public earlier and in an increased frequency might help us prevent this deadly disease. So please consider getting that earlier on if you can.
Yeah, and the key takeaway for me was the increase in incidence of colorectal cancer in people younger than 55, with rates increasing 1% to 2% per year since the mid-1990s. That's crazy and sad.
And here we are. So thank you, everyone. I wanted to give a special thanks to all our guests here today, Megan, Dr. Ajay, and Dr. Subri. For those of you who do not know, there is a snow blizzard outside today. The roads are really bad. So this is awesome that all of these people could drive to the studio here in Lorth Loop, downtown Minneapolis, and decided to join us to talk on this important topic. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Another special thanks goes out to Sandy Muschenheim. She is the president of the Minnesota Colorectal Cancer Research Foundation. Sandy, a survivor herself, started this group when she realized that there was not enough money going into funding the colorectal cancer research. So her group, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, supports research not only in University of Minnesota, but also in Mayo, and they support ongoing research on colorectal cancer. Finally, last but not the least, we cannot thank two people, Sam Devine and Juliet Fox, enough. We are sitting here in this very nice Divine Fox Productions studio. This is the place where we are recording our podcasts, and they are also helping us with post-production and post-editing of the podcast episode. So thank you guys. You have been amazing, amazing help. Thanks.
Yes, thank you so much. And join us next month, where we will be working on an episode all about Alzheimer's disease, and it will drop by the end of April. And then May, we'll be looking at mental health. But we can't do this all alone, even with the great help from Sam and Julia. We need sponsors to help cover our production costs. So if you're interested in sponsoring this very unique and groundbreaking podcast.
I like that.
Please contact Rashmi@healthcare.mn. And in the meantime, be well, be strong, and keep innovating. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you again in April.